Welcome to today's deep dive. So I want you to imagine holding this small, just totally unassuming button in your hand.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
Right. And if you press this button, it will instantly, I mean, just irreparably ruin the career and the reputation of someone who deeply and maliciously betrayed you.
Oh, wow. That's a heavily loaded button.
It is. And the kicker is, no one would ever know you pressed it. There are no fingerprints, no digital trail, just pure, unadulterated payback.
Man, that's tempting.
Exactly. So the question for you, the listener, is would you push it? And I guess more importantly, why is your brain like practically screaming at you to smash that butter with a hammer?
Well, I mean, that urge to press the button, it's one of the most universally tempting, deeply human, and honestly, highly combustible psychological states we can
Yeah,
experience.
combustible is a good word for it.
It really is. Because it's the absolute definition of stepping out of the realm of simply repairing a harm and wading into the incredibly muddy waters of vengeance.
Which is exactly what we're getting into today. We are unpacking a deeply comprehensive research report from the American newspaper and American TV. It's titled Revenge: Psychology, Justice, History, and Strategy.
Fantastic piece of research.
It really is. And our mission for this deep dive is to look at the biological traps our brains set for us, how human society had to, evolve workarounds just to survive this impulse,
Right.
and most importantly, how you can strategically navigate being wronged in the real world without detonating your own life in the process.
Because that's the real danger, isn't it? Getting caught in the blast radius of your own retaliation.
Exactly. So, okay, let's unpack this because we need to set a baseline first. The report draws a very sharp boundary between two concepts that we normally just blur together.
Yeah, retaliation and revenge.
Right. Retaliation or punishment functions essentially as a stop sign, right?
Yes, it's a protective measure. Its whole purpose is aimed at halting bad behavior. But revenge is entirely distinct. The text defines revenge as this intentional response where the suffering of the wrongdoer is the actual goal.
Like their pain becomes intrinsically valuable to you.
Exactly.
We can look at this through the lens of, say, a property dispute. Like, say your neighbor's dog keeps digging up your backyard.
Super annoying.
Super annoying. But building a taller fence or even suing them in small claims court for the landscaping bill, that's reparative.
Right, you are protecting your boundaries, you're recovering your actual costs.
But sneaking over at night and like pouring bleach on their prized rose bushes,
That's dark.
it's totally dark. And that doesn't fix your lawn. That is purely about taking the frustration and loss you experienced and just transferring it directly onto them.
Right, and the diagnostic question the report poses here is just brilliant. They ask, would your actions still seem worthwhile to you if the offender never actually suffered? Or, if they never even learned that you were behind it?
That really clarifies it.
It does, because if you need them to feel fear or humiliation or pain, specifically because they inflicted those feelings on you, well, you're no longer protecting yourself.
You've crossed the Rubicon.
Exactly. You've crossed into revenge.
Which brings up this massive biological contradiction. If revenge is this totally destructive, counterproductive force, why does the pull feel so magnetic?
Yeah, it feels visceral.
It really does. It feels like a physical craving. Why is that?
Well, the neuroscience behind this is fascinating. The report highlights a landmark study by a researcher named de Crevain.
Okay.
And this study monitored the brain activity of participants who were actively anticipating punishing someone who had violated their trust.
And what happened?
Their brain's reward center, specifically this region called the dorsal striatum, it just lit up
Well, it's the
intensely.
dorsal striatum, but isn't that the same region that lights up when we anticipate a reward from like a goal-directed action,
Yes, exactly.
like eating when we're starving or winning a game?
Spot on. It is. From a strictly neurological standpoint, provocation alters how your brain values aggression in that specific moment.
Wow.
Your brain is actively anticipating revenge as this quote-unquote sweet reward, and it's preparing to give you a massive hit of satisfaction.
But wait, if my brain is literally dispensing chemical rewards to encourage me to crush my enemy, aren't we just biologically hardwired to seek vengeance?
It certainly seems that way
It
initially.
sounds to me like revenge is essentially the psychological equivalent of junk food.
Oh, I like that analogy.
Right, like the craving is incredibly intense. It's probably rooted in some ancient survival mechanism where we needed those calories, but actually consuming it makes you sick.
The data strongly supports that analogy.
Right.
Researchers actually call this phenomenon the hedonic forecasting error.
Hedonic forecasting error. What does that mean in practice?
Well, there's a crucial study by Carl Smith, Wilson, and Gilbert detailed in the report.
Oh.
And it looks at how we predict a future action will make us feel.
Okay, so like our internal forecasting.
Right. And when it comes to revenge, our internal forecasting is massively flawed. Participants in the study almost universally predicted that punishing an offender would, you know, bring them closure. They thought it would make them feel significantly better.
Let me guess. It does the exact opposite.
You nailed it. The people who actually took the opportunity to punish the offender ended up ruminating on the event far, far more.
Oh, wow.
And they reported feeling demonstrably worse than the participants who chose not to retaliate at all.
See, I want to dig into the why of that. If the dorsal striatum wants the reward so badly, why does the actual follow-through leave us feeling so miserable?
Right, it's a huge disconnect.
It has to be an evolutionary mismatch, right? Like, our brains evolved on the savanna to manage immediate short-term survival.
Yes, exactly.
So the brain is incredibly good at forecasting the next 5 minutes, that burst of dopamine when you strike back at a threat. But it is just terrible at forecasting the next 5 months of complex social fallout.
That is exactly what happens. Because taking action guarantees that the offender remains psychologically present in your everyday life.
Yeah.
When you execute a revenge plot, you have basically opened a cognitive file that you now have to constantly update.
Oh, man. Like, did they understand the message?
Was the punishment severe enough?
Right. Or are they planning to counterattack?
Exactly. You continually edit and replay the event in your mind. So the anticipated reward is immediate, that quick hit in the dorsal striatum, but the psychological cost of endless rumination, that lasts for weeks, months, or even years.
Okay, but if our individual brains are hardwired with this glitch where we endlessly obsess over getting even, but doing so just triggers more obsession, putting early humans in close quarters should have resulted in immediate extinction.
You would think so, yeah.
How did we not just wipe our own species out in a global, never-ending blood feud?
Well, we had to invent a workaround. And if we look at history, those early blood feuds weren't just chaotic expressions of anger.
What were they?
In kin-based societies, you have to remember, there were no centralized police forces. There were no court systems, no impartial judges.
Right. It was just your tribe or your clan.
Exactly. So if someone wronged you or your family, it was a direct threat to your clan's actual survival.
Because if someone steals your livestock and you do nothing, you basically just broadcast to every neighboring tribe that your group is easy prey.
Right. So a blood feud was essentially a crude, brutal system of collective security. A reputation for devastating retaliation was really your only deterrent.
Okay, that makes sense.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, this is where the concept of lex talionis emerged.
Lex talionis? Wait, is that an eye for an eye?
It is, which we commonly know today as an eye for an eye. And modern culture often misinterprets that as this barbaric mandate to exact revenge.
Yeah, it sounds super brutal to us now.
But historically, it was actually designed as a progressive limit on violence.
Okay, that makes total sense. Before an eye for an eye, a clan might slaughter an entire neighboring village just because of one stolen sheep.
Exactly. The talionic formula introduced the concept of proportional equivalence.
Right.
It explicitly stated that the punishment cannot exceed the original wrong. So only an eye for an eye, not an entire life for an eye.
But even with that structural limit, the system was basically doomed by human psychology, right?
Completely doomed. The fundamental flaw was that responsibility was spread across entire families and establishing neutral, universally accepted facts. It was impossible.
Let's picture how that actually plays out. Imagine two families living next to each other. Family A's sheep wanders into Family B's garden and eats all their crops.
Right.
So Family B retaliates by killing the sheep. To Family B, they just executed proportional justice, eye for an eye.
But Family A didn't see the sheep eating the crops.
Exactly. They just see a dead sheep. So Family A retaliates by burning down Family B's barn.
And there you go. Every single act of retaliation creates a fresh, totally unprovoked grievance in the eyes of the other side.
Because they view your version of justice as an attack on their honor.
Right. This structural blindness guarantees these intergenerational cycles of violence where both sides genuinely truly believed they were the victims just settling the score.
So we needed a circuit breaker. We needed something to stop everyone from acting as their own judge, jury, and executioner.
And that circuit breaker was the rise of centralized authority, specifically royal courts and the early state. Rulers fundamentally redefined the meaning of a crime.
How so?
A homicide or a theft was no longer treated merely as a private wrong against a victim's family. It was reclassified as a quote-unquote breach of the king's peace.
Oh, wow. So fines and penalties that historically went to the victim's family started flowing to the public authority.
Yes. We traded the visceral, emotional satisfaction of personal vengeance for the stability of constitutional law.
Because public prosecution separates the victim's personal desire for suffering from society's broader need to maintain order.
Exactly. And constitutional law demands everything that revenge hates. It demands physical evidence, strict impartiality, proportional sentencing, and a presumption of innocence. We outsourced our vengeance to the state.
We gave up our private license to destroy in exchange for a system that actually distinguishes truth-finding from partisan accusation.
We did.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. We successfully outsourced the physical act of vengeance, but we clearly haven't outsourced the emotional craving.
Not even a little bit.
Right. That dorsal striatum is still lighting up in our brains today.
Huh.
And if we can't legally burn down our rival's barn anymore, all that psychological energy has to go somewhere.
And it goes straight into our stories.
It really does. The entertainment value of vengeance is unparalleled. Our cultural obsession with revenge narratives spans all of human history.
Absolutely.
You see it in the ancient Greek tragedy of the Oresteia. You see it in Shakespeare's Hamlet, Melville's Moby Dick.
And modern pop culture is completely saturated with it.
Oh, totally. We love The Count of Monte Cristo, John Wick, and those incredibly elaborate, just beautifully stylish Korean revenge dramas.
Right. The genre is universally beloved because we crave watching a victim who is completely helpless transform into this patient, omniscient avenger.
Someone who methodically dismantles the people who wronged them. It feels so good to watch.
It does. And the report highlights exactly why catharsis works so perfectly in fiction. A novel or a movie provides the moral clarity that real life completely lacks.
Because in a revenge thriller, you know with absolute certainty that the villain is truly evil and deserving of their fate.
Exactly. You get to ride along and experience the competence of the avenger and the reversal of their status, all without bearing any of the real-world legal, relational, or physical costs.
But if I try to pull a Count of Monte Cristo in real life, if I spend 5 years plotting this elaborate scheme to financially and socially ruin a coworker who stole my promotion, I'm not going to look like a stylish anti-hero.
No, you're really not.
I am going to run headfirst into what the report calls the captivity paradox.
And the captivity paradox is the ultimate tragedy of real-world revenge. When you commit to executing a revenge plot, you have to plan. You have to monitor your target's movements.
Right.
You have to rehearse your actions, maintain strict secrecy, and constantly anticipate their countermoves.
You're essentially packing this heavy rucksack full of boulders, hauling it around your neck every single day, just waiting for the perfect moment to throw one at your enemy.
That's a great way to put it.
But you are the one bearing the crushing weight of the rocks the entire time. You literally take yourself hostage.
Yeah, that's the paradox. Revenge promises to free you from the pain of the original injury, but the actual mechanics of revenge require your continued obsessive devotion to that injury. The original offender ends up occupying vastly more of your time, your thoughts, and your energy after you start your revenge project than they did before.
The report visualizes this brilliantly with a concept called the cost horizon graph.
Yes, this is so eye-opening.
For everyone listening, imagine a line chart tracking a real-world act of revenge. In the first few minutes or days after you strike back, there is this sharp upward spike. You feel a sudden discharge of arousal, maybe a fleeting sense of control.
But that relief line drops off a cliff almost immediately.
While the second line on the graph, the cost line, compounds exponentially for years.
Right. The legal bills pile up. Your professional reputation is damaged.
Your friends and family go exhausted from hearing about your obsessive crusade.
You open yourself up to defamation suits or termination. Your target now dictates the direction of your life because every move you make is a reaction to their existence.
Look at Captain Ahab in Moby Dick as like the ultimate literary warning for the captivity paradox.
Oh, absolutely.
His injury, losing his leg to the whale, distorts his entire metaphysics. His identity shrinks until his whole world is organized around defeating the object that wounded him.
And he sacrifices his ship, his crew, and his own life just to strike at the whale.
But since we don't live in a movie, and acting on impulse traps us in that paradox, we have to look at the actual playbook.
Right. What do we actually do?
Exactly. What do you do when you, the person listening to this deep dive right now, are betrayed by a trusted business partner who embezzles from your company? or undermined by a deeply toxic coworker?
This raises an important question, because the takeaway here is absolutely not to roll over and be a passive doormat.
Definitely not.
The report is explicitly clear that you can, and often must, impose severe costs on someone to protect yourself.
Right. A business can and should sue a partner for breach of contract to recover stolen funds.
An employer must fire someone for misconduct. You can litigate, you can sever ties, you can enforce strict boundaries.
So it's all about the underlying motivation. Taking protective action imposes heavy costs on the wrongdoer, but it only crosses the line into revenge when you push past what is necessary for your protection, simply to ensure they suffer as much as you did.
Exactly. And to help navigate that really treacherous line, the report provides a highly practical framework.
Yes, the 7-stage decision model.
Right. It's designed to convert emotional urgency into a lawful, evidence-based strategy.
Let's walk through the mechanics of this model, because the execution is where most people fail. Step one is the most urgent and neurologically the most difficult. Stabilize.
Stabilize, meaning do not send that scorching email at 2 a.m.
Do not post an explosive accusation on social media.
Do not confront them in the parking lot.
Right, because when your dorsal striatum is demanding that dopamine hit, you are highly aroused and primed to make irreversible, self-destructive decisions that will immediately hand your leverage over to the person who wronged you.
You have to create physical and temporal distance. Sleep on it.
Once you stabilize, you move to step two. Define the objective.
You must replace the vague emotional desire of I want to destroy them with concrete, measurable outcomes.
What do you actually require to be whole again? Do you need your intellectual property return?
Do you need a neutral reference for your next job? Do you need a restraining order?
Defining a concrete objective is how you reclaim your agency from the chaos of the injury.
And the middle stages of the model are all about assessing your actual leverage, gathering documented evidence, and identifying the risks involved in taking action.
You are basically acting like an investigator in your own life, moving away from emotion and towards structural power.
Exactly, which leads to step six. Choose the least destructive, effective option.
And the phrase least destructive often trips people up.
It does, because it does not mean choosing a weak or timid option.
Right. Imagine you have a toxic employee who is actively sabotaging your team. The revenge option is to publicly humiliate them in a staff meeting, scream at them, and try to ruin their reputation in the industry.
That is highly destructive, and it exposes you to HR grievances, lawsuits, and the loss of respect from your other employees.
So the least destructive effective option is a meticulously documented, quiet, and ruthless termination of that employee, backed by an airtight paper trail.
Exactly. A targeted injunction from a judge is infinitely more powerful than launching an unverified public smear campaign. You secure your objective while preserving your future choices and minimizing your own legal exposure.
This brings us to a concept that often makes people cringe in these situations. Forgiveness.
Yeah, that's a tough word for a lot of people.
The report addresses it, but it frames forgiveness in a way that completely upends the traditional definition. If I am following this 7-stage model and I'm methodically choosing the least destructive option, does that mean I'm supposed to just forgive and forget?
Right. It sounds a lot like letting them get away with it.
It really does.
But society routinely conflates forgiveness with reconciliation, or dropping a lawsuit, or excusing abhorrent behavior. The research, specifically highlighting studies by psychologists Toussaint and Kim, redefines forgiveness as purely an internal release of resentment.
Internal. Meaning the forgiveness is a tool used entirely for my own benefit, completely independent of the offender.
Exactly. It does not erase the historical facts of the betrayal. It does not mean you have to trust the person ever again or invite them back into your life.
Wow.
You can forgive someone internally to lower your own cortisol levels, reduce your blood pressure, and stop organizing your inner thoughts around their repayment.
And you can achieve that internal peace while simultaneously, factually, and ruthlessly suing them for every penny they stole from you.
Yes. You can forgive them in the quiet of your own heart while your lawyer deposes them in a conference room.
That is an incredibly empowering distinction. Forgiveness is a health strategy for the victim. It is not a shield to protect the offender from accountability.
The ultimate lesson of this research is about mastering control. The most profound response you can deliver to someone who wronged you is to ensure their act fails in its deepest, most fundamental objective.
If their betrayal was designed to frighten you, you methodically restore your safety.
If their goal was to humiliate you, you strictly preserve your dignity.
If they wanted to control your future, you completely reclaim authorship of it.
Exactly. You refuse to purchase a fleeting moment of emotional satisfaction by surrendering your liberty, your credibility, or your life's purpose to their narrative.
So, what does this all mean for you? We always hear that old cliche, you know, living well is the best revenge.
Right.
But that cliche is fundamentally flawed if it means you are just trying to prove your happiness to the person who hurt you.
Because if you are still checking to see if they noticed your success, you are still trapped in the captivity paradox.
True victory isn't about proving anything to them at all. It is about outgrowing them entirely.
Yes.
Think about what happens when you evolve your life, your mindset, and your goals so profoundly that the offender couldn't even comprehend the person you've become.
Right. You aren't just getting credit for that one project they tried to steal. You've moved on to innovating the entire industry.
By outgrowing the grievance, you render their original attack completely irrelevant to your new reality. You didn't just fix the leaky pipe, and you didn't waste your life trying to drown the plumber.
No.
You moved out of the house, bought a better one on higher ground, and forgot the plumber's name altogether.
That is the definition of true freedom.
Something to mull over the next time you feel the urge to press that button and get even. Thanks for taking this deep dive with us today.